When you can't talk about the ethics of anything, whenever I do a talk like this, almost feel like I have to apologize at the start that I'm not going to answer all of your questions. Because inevitably in a group like this, some people come with some very specific questions. On a topic like this, there is any number of things that we could talk about. And the direction I'm going to go maybe won't meet your specific question, but I'm happy to engage afterwards with any kind of specific question. Because IVF as a topic opens up a whole range of things, not just about treatment of infertility, but about, for instance, what this means for our view of marriage and children and society and a whole range of other things that technology like this actually changes the way that we potentially will operate as a society with regard to some of those things. And we've already seen that starting to happen already. So if you've got specific questions that I don't answer, and I know that I won't be answering everything, because although we said I've got a bit of time, I don't have that much time, please come and speak to me over lunch or later in the day. Some of what I'm going to say will sort of align very much and maybe even repeat a little bit what Anna has said. This issue of infertility, in some sense, the way that we deal with it is a very modern issue, although, as Anna said, it's not a modern issue. It's been a human issue since the fall, really. But as we come to think about IVF in particular, or the bigger term, artificial reproductive technology, it is a modern issue in a sense. As we grow in our knowledge of what it is that is functional or dysfunctional, if you like, that what it is that is at ease or diseased, what it is that is going well or not going well, as we understand who we are as human beings and the biology of that and all those kind of things, and understand our human experience, we also open up possibilities of interacting with that. And increasingly, we have an expectation that we will be able to interact with that. It wasn't that long ago, really, that if you went to a hospital, you didn't go there with any great expectation of getting healed and coming home. You went there with a fairly bleak outcome sort of in mind, you know. It's only fairly modern, a fairly modern occurrence, really, that if you have some sort of sickness or illness, that you expect that we'll be able to fix it. That the medical knowledge that we have, the way that we understand ourselves, the technologies that can apply to it, that we'll be able to fix whatever it is that's wrong. And that's raised also this kind of sense within ourselves, and rightly so to a great extent, but not to a full extent, that we can control our own destiny in regard to some of these medical issues. There's a whole range of things we could talk about, the medicalisation of life, actually, that we actually now have a whole range of things that we do to ourselves with this expectation that medicine, in its broader sense, will just impact on us day by day. And we expect that, you know, I've got a bit of sore knee at the moment. I'm kind of going, what's going on there? I wonder if I should go and get an X-ray or some sort of scan and see if they can see what's wrong and fix it up. You know, that's a fairly new way of viewing these things. But the difficulty with IVF, if you like, in that context, is not just a medical issue. It's a very sensitive and personal and private, to some extent, issue. It's an issue, and particularly in a Christian context, and most of what I'm going to say is going to assume a Christian marriage context, but I don't want to in any way sort of step away from the fact that this IVF opens up the possibility for just seeing children as a thing that can be brought in, particularly a single woman who has no view of wanting to get married or anything like that. IVF opens up that possibility in a different way. But I want to talk about it from a Christian marriage perspective. And usually the issues around when you'll seek to have children, the intimacy of the sexual relationship that sort of is tied up with both having children but also with the whole sort of medicalisation of this thing, they're usually private issues. And maybe they should be more pastoral issues that you will engage with those who are trusted pastors or friends or Christian brothers or sisters. But increasingly, I'm realizing that most often we don't deal with that kind of engagement as brothers and sisters in Christ until very late in the piece. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. So what about the fact that this is a modern issue in the sense that it seems to be, there seems to be more awareness or maybe even more infertility. Now, I don't want you to hear as I'm pointing out some of these things. I want you to have stuck in your minds what Anna said at the end, that unless you're very careful about the way you describe some of this stuff that I'm going, it can very quickly sound like you're blaming the woman, and that's not what I'm doing here. But I want to sort of point out a few ways that that just by the nature of who we are as a society in general, not any particular person, but as a society in general, why it might be that there's more infertility on a population level. It shouldn't come as a surprise that as a woman grows older and gets to that point of menopause, infertility becomes a reality just by the natural biological processes that go on in their life. Once you've reached menopause, then infertility is just there. It is what it is. Now, as we as a society delay childbirth to some extent, as people get married later and delay childbirth in that way, people's fertility levels decrease as they get older. So some people might say that there's a choice in that. It might not be your choice, though. It might be just personal circumstances. And I think this is a particular issue amongst the Christian community where we want Christian marriages to be between two Christian people. And so some people might say, well, it's not my choice. I desire to get married, but there isn't a Christian partner for me at this point in time. And so I won't get married. So it may be social circumstances, that or others. And also, there is a body of evidence that say sustained contraception can sometimes delay when a woman who stops taking the pill, various pill, stops for a time. There may be a delay in between when she stops and when she starts to be fertile again. So all of these things can add to this this sort of seeming increase in infertility. But there could be personal physical factors as well, some medical condition, some sexually transmitted diseases. There's some evidence and contested space about how diet or weight or stress can impact on fertility. And then there's a even shakier body of evidence, but it's out there, about environmental factors. We live in a world that's that is soaked with artificial chemicals and other things. And there's some people that say, well, one of the reasons why we have a growing instance of infertility has got something to do with that. I'm not sure that the evidence is in on that. But all of these things together sort of a building into this picture and building into this growing incidence of infertility. So Anna's already mentioned some of this. About 10% of women between 15 and 14 have some impaired fecundity. So it's not fertility, but that's the having a child. So that's the whole thing, not just falling pregnant, but having a child. And that drastically increases after 40. And just generally speaking, in big kind of rough numbers, but infertility within a couple, it's about 30% can be traced to the man, 30% to the woman, 30% both the man and the woman, and then 10% unknown causes. So that's good to, again, good to keep in mind, because we're going to come back to what that might mean for relationships in a little while. Feel free if you don't understand something or you want something clarified to shoot your hand up. I'm happy to take some questions as we go along. But the more questions you have, the less likely I am to get to the end. One of the other issues around this idea of infertility is We have a different expectation of how the childless couple who desire a child will see that child come into their family because of the medicalization that's happened. So not that long ago, if you were a childless couple, then adoption would be the way that you would look, because the medical treatment options weren't necessarily understood or there to be had. But adoption increasingly is on the decline, and I'll talk a little bit more about this. There's less babies, increasingly less babies up for adoption, and adoption seems to be, and it is, so Anglicare do adoptions and out-of-home care foster services, so I know about this. It's complicated. It's not a simple process. It takes years to get adoptions organised and appropriately through. So it's not a simple process, and it could be a costly process as well. I'm not going to go into the costs and complications of adoption. But one of the reasons for that less babies up for adoption, and often when we're talking about infertile couples wanting a child into their home, they're looking to take a baby, not a 16-year-old who is in the foster care system, who has all sorts of issues and problems, going from being a childless couple to dealing with, like I've got teenagers, I've got adult children now. I couldn't imagine sort of being dumped into being expected to be a parent of a 16-year-old, let alone a 16-year-old who has enormous problems. So most people who are wanting adoption are looking for babies. The reality is, the reason why there's not as many babies up for adoption is because abortion has become just such a common and accepted practice that unwanted pregnancies are dealt with before the baby is born. And so the baby isn't there to be adopted out. But the other thing too is, and this is where IVF really comes into its own, is most people with good reason, a couple who are committed to one another, desire a child of their own. Now this can be seen either positively or negatively, but you want to bring your child into the world. Now it could also be that you want to construct this child of your own, and you want to, all your deficiencies you want to get right, you want to live your life through them and all that kind of stuff that parents struggle with. Or it could be that you want to have the child like the holiday or the car or the house, or just to add to the complement of what will make life complete. And there's a whole range of dysfunctionality that can happen with that. But there's something good about a Christian couple desiring a child of their own, desiring that God would give them this gift, that they would be able to welcome this little one into the loving embrace of their family. There's something good about that. Just want to point out this graph to you. This is a graph. All sorts of amazing statistics from the Australian Bureau of Statistics website, I've got to say. If you're ever bored and you want to do something useful on Google, then so this is a graph of age-specific fertility rates through these specific age groups from the 1930s up to 2011. And the two lines here indicate two big things that happen, one sort of legal social and one social medical. So the red line here was the introduction of the contraceptive pill. Now you can see straight away in the age groups, most of the age groups apart from the very young, a drop in the fertility rates at the introduction of the contraceptive pill. So the pill gave control to women about when they would fall pregnant, and you see that you can see that matched out. The green line was the first successful IVF baby in the early 70s in Australia. It was in Melbourne. And what you see pretty much straight away is that in the 30 to 34 age group, it pretty quickly starts to kick up again. 35 to 39 again starts to kick up again. So there's a lot more we could kind of discuss and analyse in that graph. But I just wanted to make the point that any of these technologies, whether it be the pill for contraception to stop having kids, or IVF to cure infertility, has a massive social change going on as well. And you can see that by the change in fertility rates over time in this graph. Now, I don't want to dwell on that too much, but it's good to have that in mind, because as we talk about the ethics of IVF, although rightly we want to be talking about the individual couple, and we'll talk about embryos in a minute, this ethics is not just about what I do or even what we do as a married couple. Ethics also is about what this means for us as a society as well. And that can get pretty complicated, can't it, pretty quickly. One other thing I want to say about infertility and IVF before we start to think about what might be some of the ethics in this, and this will lead us into my first point, is as much, and Anna was talking about this before, as much as infertility is a grievous thing. It is a grievous thing. It's not what God intended. It's a consequence of our stepping away. Not necessarily my personally stepping away from God. It's not a curse, but our stepping away as humanity from God and from His good purposes for us. It's a grievous thing. Grief is just a response to any form of loss. That's what grief is. It doesn't have to be that somebody has died. That's not the only grief. We understand that as a grief, but the lost prospect of having a child is a grievous thing. You've lost something. You've lost that hope, that desire, that good thing that could be yours, that possibility of that good thing. And so infertility comes with grief. Artificial reproductive technology, or IVF as a kind of component of that, opens the possibility of that grief being undone, doesn't it? You know, the possibility with this great medical advance that your infertility might be cured, that you might have a child of your own, that heartfelt desire that you have together as a married couple would come to fruition. But as you think about it, and as we'll look at some of the statistics around success rates, if you like, it also opens yourself up to a double grief. Because as much as the big billboard ads, so I was driving yesterday in Sydney, and I noticed again a huge billboard advertising IVF services as you come off the M5 onto the coming down this way, actually. It's a huge, big advertising billboard that offers out this great hope. Just go along to whatever the IVF provider was and you'll come away with a baby in 9 months' time. You know, it's not that simple. but that hope that is offered out actually opens ourselves up for a double grief. It may not be like that. And so as you think about this as a couple, you've also got to be ready for that as well. One of the other things we have to think about too is, if you decide that as a couple that IVF is the thing for you, then a wise thing to do is think about when will enough be enough? Because as much as you'd like to think that you'll just go in and one cycle, and we'll talk about what cycles of IVF look, one cycle will result in a pregnancy, and that pregnancy will result in a baby born. That's actually could be very far from reality. It could be that you could keep going through cycle after cycle after cycle, and each one of those costs, and we'll talk about just some rough ideas about costs. When will enough be enough? Before you start having some concept that just because you've invested so much, not just financially but emotionally and relationally in IVF, just because you've invested so much, does that mean you should keep going until you get a result, or will you together at the beginning think, this is what we're willing to do. This is what we think we should do. And just recognising that in this process there's going to be a lot of joy and pain. joy if it comes to fruition and you do have that child that you much desired. And pain, even if it does come to fruition, like Anna was saying, you know, if you have been infertile for a period of time and then you do have a child, that pain still is with you. That's just really context setting in some ways. And then I want to talk about some ethics. Now, when you hear, there's going to be a talk on the ethics of IVF, most people will very quickly go to, great, we're going to hear about the status of the embryo and whether or not the embryo is a human person, and that's going to be the main ethical thrust, because unless we get that right, everything else is irrelevant, because it, you know, depending on what you think of the embryo, that makes a whole lot of sense about the whole thing called IVF. Now, all of that's true to some extent, but Christian ethics at its heart and in its more sort of comprehensive view is not just about solving particularly problematic kind of status issues, like the status of the embryo or whether or not you should lie to the Nazis if they're at your door and you've got Jews in your upstairs room. You know? Sometimes we like to think about ethics in those kind of terms, but what the Bible tells us for those who follow Jesus Christ is ethics is actually the discipline of being a disciple of Jesus. Ethics is actually seeking to live life in light of who he is, how he's made us, what he's done to draw us back into relationship with him, and what that will mean for our relationship with him, our relationship with one another, and our relationship with the world that he's given us to live in. Ethics is about relationships. Jesus is asked, you know, what are the greatest laws? The two laws that he speaks about are laws about relating to God and relating to one another. Love the Lord your God. Love your neighbour as yourself. When Jesus is speaking into the space of what we should do, you go and read this for yourself. It's most often how we should relate. That's most often. So even with some of the commands, if you think, do not steal. It's not just because stealing is bad. It's because what it does to the relationships involved, you and the person you've stolen from, and the relationships that we have, the trust that we have for one another in society. Like if we all stole from one another, there'd be no trust. You see, ethics is about relationships. And that's where I want to start as we think about the ethics of this space, because whatever we say about what comes next, for the Christian couple who are infertile, the biggest ethical issues I would contend are, what does this mean for your relationship? And however you're going to approach this grief in your life, whether or not you say we can't have children and that's okay and we won't try and do something medically about it, or we might go and adopt, or we can't have children and we want to actually see whether there's some medical intervention that might help us with this. Whatever path you take, irrelevant of which path you take, your relationship is, and how you act in that relationship is going to be really important. One of the biggest issues with infertility is the shame and blame that inevitably flow into the relationship. Because as much as you love one another, as much as you kind of prize that commitment that you have to one another, when something goes wrong in that relationship and one party feels it's my fault, if only my body was working better than this, they feel shame. That's relationship destroying. Or the other party, as much as they love and they don't want to think this, but they desperately want children, and as much as they don't want to, there's a sense of, if only their body was working better. And you can have blame in a relationship. So the first thing to say about the ethics of IVF is actually more about the ethics of the relationship in this couple. how are you going to, if you're involved in that, how are you going to protect and nurture and care for one another through this? And if you're outside of that marriage relationship, how as church, as brothers and sisters in Christ, are you going to care and support, and not intrusively, but in hopefully you will have developed your relationships as brothers and sisters in Christ in the good times, so that when it comes to the bad times for one another, that you'll be able to help honour this marriage and foster as much as you can what you can do to care for them. The first thing to say about any ethical issue is, how does it impact on relationships? But there's going to be some other questions as well. So if we take, and I think this is the way the scriptures describe it, that the children are to be welcomed into the world in the context of a lifelong relationship called marriage, and usually that will happen in this sort of one flesh union that the Bible talks about, this faithful, exclusive relationship. It usually happens between a man and a woman. It's a private, it's an intimate thing. Conception happens in that kind of private, intimate moment of sexual intimacy. But IVF opens up the possibilities of other parties being involved. Maybe you would think about a sperm donor or an egg donor or possibly even a surrogate, and all of the possibilities are there. And there's a whole range of ethical issues about that. But in the end, it does come back to, what do you make of this third party involved in this relationship as well? I'm not going to dwell too much on that one, but it's something that's really, there's a lot to say about that one. And then the other issue, which you might think about before we get to the embryo, is that concept of commodification that I talked about before. Any time that we as human beings, invest, speak about other human beings in a way that is sort of flows out of a view of almost like a financial transaction kind of view of this person can do something for me or can be something for me. It's sort of, there's a potential for us, particularly for the child that you've so desired, so invested in, so put so much energy and effort in, that you've so carefully constructed, that you've so earnestly desired and spent so much money on. There's a sense that that this child can become a commodity. In your worst of times as a parent, when they're not doing everything that you wanted them to do, you'd never dream of saying it. I couldn't guarantee that I wouldn't say it, because I know I've said some pretty awful things to my kids when they've been that way. But do you know how much you cost me? You might think it. Do you know how much I wanted you? Do you know how much I invested into you to get you into this world? All of those sort of dysfunctional ways of thinking about another human being are potentially there. For the child that's born through artificial reproductive technology, an IVF. So there's a big kind of group of things that are all worth thinking about that we may not even think about at all, because we're often just interested in what we think of the embryo. But ethics is so much bigger than that, so much bigger than that. And that sort of, we should talk about this. Though, the embryo, because the life of the unwanted, the life of the wanted child, in a sense, when we start to talk about IVF, we've got to think about, but what about the unwanted embryos? When the IVF provider is going to take some eggs from the woman and some sperm from the man and put them together, they're not going to just take one egg and one sperm, or even a jar full of sperm. They're going to take multiple eggs, and they're going to make multiple embryos, usually. That's what they want to do. But you don't want four embryos implanted into you if you're a woman. You don't. And they won't do it, because it's very dangerous. So what do you do with the three that you don't want? how do you think about them? Are they human persons? And if they are human persons, how does that change your view? I mean, when you recognize someone as a human person, or even if you don't recognize them as a human person, but they are a human person, the Bible will talk about us loving our neighbor. This one is a neighbor as well. What does that do for us? So, some of the questions that will arise will be, well, what do we think of the embryo? And that will raise a whole lot of questions about whether we should do this at all, or if we are to do it, what does that mean for the way that we'll do it? What does it mean for how many embryos you'd ask the IVF provider to make, if you like, to have fertilised? How many eggs will be fertilised? What will your intentionality be to any surplus embryos? Will you commit to them ahead of time if you think that they are a human person in such a way that even if you don't really want them, that you actually still value them enough to do what is right by them and for them? So to answer those questions, we really got to answer the question of when did I begin? What is the human embryo? When people go to this, we will rightly want to know what the Bible says about this. We will rightly want to know what the Bible says into this space about when does a human being begin? What passages, and this is a real question, it's not a rhetorical question, what passages would we go to in the scriptures to answer this question? When does the human being begin? Oh, that's a good one. That's the one I've got too. Any others? Any other passages that we might go to? That's the one we usually go to, and I want to speak about that for a little while. Yes. Genesis 1, did you say? Yep. So we're creating the image of God, and the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. Is that what you're thinking of? Genesis 1, yep. So there's something about what it means to be human there.
Yeah. One where the Spirit is given. John,
yeah, so there's a sense that in a few places in the scriptures, so John and also Jeremiah the prophet spoken about as being kind of having a personality, if you like, having life well before they're born, and those moments where Elizabeth meets Mary and there's a little kind of jumping around of the babies in, you know. There's a sense that the scriptures do speak about the human being born well before, being, coming into being, if you like, well before birth. That's pretty clear. But do the scriptures speak about when before birth? We know that, you know, a man and a woman have sex and then 9 months or so later a baby's born. Do the scriptures have any specificity about when the human being begins in that sort of 9 month period? We know it's before birth, and we kind of have some sense of what it means to be human, these creatures that specifically bear the image of God. We know that there's something about a human being starting at the instigation of God and this being an inspirited, embodied kind of thing. And we might go to Psalm 139 and the Psalm says at one point, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in that secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. And although it might not seem obvious straight away, that secret place is the womb. That secret place is internal to the mother. And some people might say this clearly says that From the moment of conception, the human being is born. Well, that's true actually, because the word conception just means bringing into being this new life. But does it say from the moment of fertilization, the human being is born? I think when we make scriptures like this, when we claim that scriptures like this, or any of the other scriptures that we've spoken about, say that from the moment that egg and that sperm get together, there is a new human being, when we say that the scriptures clearly say that, I think we've misunderstood scriptures. Because you know what? The Bible, as much as it is a divine book, it is God's word to us. It is also a human book. And when these texts were written, there was no understanding about eggs and sperm. It wasn't the intention of the human writers or God, I would say, to give us a biology lesson in these texts. So we don't want to make the scriptures, we don't want to pretend that the authority of the scriptures needs to somehow be bolstered by making them say more than they actually do. When we make the Bible say more than it actually does, we actually, in a very strange way, not that it can be in reality, but we actually undermine its authority. Because I don't believe that this text or any of the texts in the scriptures say that at fertilization the human being begins. But I do believe that at fertilization the human being begins. So how do I come to that conclusion? Well, the thinking person, the Christian thinking person, needs to say that in all of life, the scriptures have an authority place for us, but God has given us brains to interact with the world and to think alongside of those Christian and non-Christian alike who for many years have been pondering this question. So what does the science of embryology tell us about this thing called the embryo? What do the philosophers think when they think about this question of when did the human being begin? So I think that what we need to see here is we need to have a reverent agnosticism, aware of the limitations of the scriptures. It's not that they say nothing, but they don't give us the precision that we might like. Now, we could say a lot more about that, but I want to keep going. So what might the philosophers say about this? What is a human person? How do you define a human person? Well, the modern way of defining human persons in most of sort of the big picture philosophy, and the most common way of describing this at the moment is you know this being is a human person because they express human characteristics. So they're rational, they can use language, they have other characteristics that make them human. So you recognise another human being by the characteristics that are expressed by that other human being. Now, that sounds all right, really, doesn't it? So you can tell that one's a human and one's a monkey because there's different things that you recognise in them. Does that sound all right? You're going to go with that one? No, I'm not going to go with that one. Because who defines what the bunch of characteristics are that you group together to make one a human and one a non-human? And what happens if the person that you recognise as a human being doesn't have some of those characteristics? So the profoundly intellectually disabled person who has no communication, or none that you recognise at least, or the person at the end of their life who is suffering with profound dementia, who has lost other sort of characteristics, or at the beginning of life, maybe you lose stuff at the end of life, but at the beginning of life you're not kind of yet expressing some of those things that you will definitely express at some later point. The embryo or the fetus doesn't speak. Does that make them not human? I don't know how much a fetus thinks. There's some evidence to think that they do think lots of things and experience the world in all sorts of interesting ways. Does that make them more or less human? I used to live on King Street, Newtown, Friday night and Saturday night, as the drunk university students used to go past my place, very, very rarely, but did happen on a number of occasions, they didn't go to their place, they ended up in my front yard, and I woke up and went out, and there's a sort of a semi-comatose university student at every level, a rational being, you'd say, not. But because they're not expressing their full humanity, does that make them any less human? See, there's another way of thinking about humanity, and although this is the common way of thinking about it, and you'll see this expressed in popular culture and in various other ways of thinking about humanity. Popular culture, for instance, so if you're any Star Trek fans, So there's the next generation with the Android robot guy, Data. What is his name? Data. Anyway, they were trying to figure out whether he was human. How they did that was, could he tell a joke? You know, could he express some sort of human characteristic? There's a lot of this in popular culture, but it's not satisfying philosophically. There's another way of thinking about our humanity, which is there's something essential that is underneath and gives rise to those human characteristics that we might speak about. It's been spoken about in philosophical terms in all sorts of ways, spirit or soul. And we mentioned it from Genesis 1, didn't we, that the thing that makes us human as opposed to any of the other creatures is that we are image bearers, that God breathed the breath of life into those first human beings. Now, we could spend a lot of time talking about what that means, but I think that the sense that there is an essence that sits underneath any human characteristic that makes us human is a much more satisfying, it's a much more satisfying way of viewing this. It allows us to recognise humanity in all of its diversity and not actually dismiss or diminish some people because they aren't everything we would hope they would be. That, you know, they can't do some of the things that the modern world thinks that we should do or think or whatever. So in some sense, one of the ways that we recognize humanity is just that. We kind of have enough to say that this one before us is a human being. We don't need to assess whether or not they have the characteristics. I used to help out at a camp for intellectually disabled children, and the thing to do when you're starting to interact with someone with any disability is we start from the premise that this one is a human being. This one too is my neighbour. Just because they don't fulfil some sort of idealized criteria of what a human being. This one too is my neighbour. You know what? As I interact with that one as my neighbour, I'm confirmed in my view that they are a human being as well. But that kind of doesn't help us because is this little blob of cells my neighbour? Is this little blob of cells that we call the embryo my neighbour? What does science say about embryology that will help us here? Well, we know now that you got sperm and egg, you know, half the genetic material that makes me up in every one of my cells, well, almost every one of my cells, and half of the genetic material from my mum, half from my dad, and they come together and they form this new, unique genetic material, and then that will be the start, even at that single cell stage, that fertilised egg stage, there's everything there that will grow out and grow up into a fully realised human being. There's nothing else needed. That's the start of a story, if you like. There's something in the essence of that thing, the fertilised egg, that treated like a human being with, and we all need to have others around us to care and protect and love us in. None of us are independent enough to be able to survive in the wrong context or the wrong environment or flourish without other human beings around us, surrounding us with good relationships. None of us are. So this embryo, this one cell fertilized egg that will grow up into a fetus, that will grow up and be born into a child and a teenager and an adult and an older person and then a geriatric person who then will die. There's a continuous history from that moment of fertilisation. And when you put those things together, and there's more that I could say, but from that moment of fertilisation, that sort of continuum from fertilisation to death, there is no distinctive moment in that. There are new things that are developing as particularly in those early phases of life where we go from one cell to a recognisable entity that you kind of see the body with arms and legs and head and the heart beating. Amazing. But actually, although it's amazing in each one of those moments and hours and days, we continue to grow and develop, and it may just be spread out a little bit more in time. And then we continue to sort of diminish, and that may be spread out or compressed over a short period of time. But it is a whole continuum. So if you put those three things together, the Bible says that we start as a human individual worthy of respect because we are image bearers before we are born, and at some moment, a mysterious secret moment in our mother's wombs usually, that what makes someone a human is not the characteristics that they express, but something essentially that gives rise to those characteristics. And then biologically speaking, from that moment that the DNA comes together from the sperm and the egg, you have this new, unique individual. When you put those together, I come to the conclusion, with all of that in mind, that that thing called the embryo is a human person, worthy of my love and respect, just the same as you are worthy of my love and respect. And I'm called as one human to another, to wherever I see my neighbour or wherever I have the ability to act with my neighbour, to act especially as someone who has been transformed by the Spirit of Jesus, to act in love to them, to want their good. That's what love is. It's wanting the other's good. So with that in mind then, and coming back to IVF, we're getting there. What does that mean? What does that mean? Well, in IVF, what we see is something that's usually done internally in secret. That's an egg surrounded by a number of sperm. Don't worry, it's not year 9 PE. We won't, but we are going to see some pictures. That at some point, one of those sperm will penetrate that egg and do that thing where the DNA come together and the new human being is created in a particular way. It comes into being. IVF really just does that artificially. It takes the egg, and this is one way of doing IVF, there are other ways, but the sperm will be injected into the egg. And so what happens in kind of a normal, natural sort of way, if you like, is helped along by the science and the medical technology. In the same way that this starts to divide and you get the early embryo looking like a blob of cells, but if what I've said is true, then this is no more or less human than this or this. And then, you know, you get the joy of the cross or the pregnancy test saying, yay, you're pregnant. And then 9 months later, hey, presto, a baby. It's all that very simple, isn't it? Yeah. No. I have a number of children, and my wife, bless her, had all sorts of issues through pregnancy. So an uncomplicated pregnancy is never uncomplicated, I don't think. But that's what we hope for. That's what we desire. That's what the hope of IVF, you know, when that doesn't happen naturally, we're hoping that IVF will make it that simple, that uncomplicated. You're just sort of helping the beginning of the process along, really. That's how it's often constructed. Now, I've been using the term IVF, but it quite literally means fertilising the egg in a glass. So in vitro is just in the glass fertilisation. It's usually not a test tube. It's usually a kind of a flat petri dish kind of thing. And IVF is just one way of taking that moment of fertilisation that usually happens internally, doing it in the lab, if you like, helping along the process, whatever is deficient in that process, helping, just fixing whatever is not right. And so this couple may be able to have a child. But there are different ways that IVF can happen, and we use IVF, but there's a whole range of things that can... It could simply be that it doesn't have to happen external to the woman. It could be that all is needed is that... The male's sperm to be injected into the woman's body. It could be as simple as that. It often isn't. It could be that you need to do what I've just described there. So do the fertilization process in the petri dish. It could be that you just, all you have to do is put the sperm and the egg together in the petri dish and the fertilization will happen outside. You'll grow the embryo up to a certain stage and then it will be transplanted back. Or it could be that you need to actually help the sperm get into the egg. That's the intracytoplasmic sperm injection, like that. So, and there's more sort of technology around this, but I don't want to get too complicated this phase. But as I said before, most IVF providers, because they're in a business, okay? Their business is helping you have a baby. It is a business. And most IVF providers aren't, they want to make money, but they're not just there to make money. They're there to help you have a baby. So they will want to do whatever they can to get the best result for you. And this is where, for those of us who are Christian, who have a view of the embryo, that this embryo is a human person, we'll need to do some negotiation, if you like. Both internally as a couple to start with, is this something we should do? And then also, if it is something we should do, what would we do differently? So if you have multiple embryos, multiple eggs fertilized, multiple embryos sitting there, but they're not going to put multiple, they're not going to put multiple embryos into you as a woman. Multiple births are very dangerous. In the initial phases of IVF, that's what they used to do. They used to sort of, have four eggs fertilized and chuck them all in, see what happens. And sometimes that went all right, and sometimes it went terribly bad. The complications from multiple births, the more twins, more complicated than singles, triplets, even more complicated. You get the picture. IVF providers don't do that anymore. They want to inject a single egg, usually a single fertilized egg, a single embryo. So what are you going to do with the leftovers? You can freeze embryos and then thaw them out later and have them implanted. But is that what we should be doing? And if it is what we should be doing, then what commitment will you have as a couple to those frozen little neighbours? Will you commit yourself to coming back and using them all? Or will you walk away from them and think, I have a baby now and I don't need to worry about them? There's some of the issues that you're going to have to think through. But the actual process is not a simple process either. To get the eggs, you, as a woman, you'll need to go through a course of hormone injections to take the follicles where the eggs are produced to stimulate them to release the eggs. So you get multiple eggs released all at the same time. Then they'll have to collect those eggs. And that collection is it's not usually quite that surgical now, but it's a surgical process. It's not as uncomplicated as sperm collection, let's say, although there are complications there we could talk about as well. But it's a surgical, it's a medical process. And then those eggs and the sperm will be fertilized, and then you can store the leftovers in liquid nitrogen and put them on ice, basically, and they're there for a time. After the fertilized egg will be sort of injected back in, that's a little less complicated, sort of injected back into the uterus, and then hopefully a pregnancy will ensue, and then after a normal pregnancy, if you like, the baby carried to full term will be born. That's the hope. But the reality is that although the advertising might say, come to us, you don't have a baby, you want a baby, we'll give you a baby, the reality is that the success rates aren't nearly as good as you might like them to be. So here's a graph from one of the IVF providers themselves. There's some contention about whether or not these are the real data, but this is their data from one of the IVF providers. So this is clinical pregnancies and after embryo transfer, and then live births after embryo transfer. And you can see that as you get older, the success rate drops. So if you're in your 30s, so 30s to 40s, then clinical pregnancies after embryo transfer, this company says you should expect a 30% success rate. So each cycle that you do, only one in three about would result in a pregnancy. And then live births after that transfer is 25%, so one in four. So it's not necessarily even the best sort of less than 30 years. It's still not a kind of guarantee, if you like. How do you think about that as well? What do you make of just the possibility of success or failure in those terms? So another way of looking at that is, this is data collected from a whole range of assisted reproductive providers across Australia and New Zealand in 2011. And this data shows that in a year period, there were 40,000 treatment cycles started, 30,000 continued to egg collection, 37,000 continued egg collection, 31,000 to embryo transfer, 9,000 pregnancies were established across the whole broad, that's 29%, and only 6,900 or so live births. So 17% from the very start of process to the very end across a whole range of IVF providers, a whole range of women, a whole range of ages. 17%. So if success is live birth, which is what the infertile couple is hoping for, this is what they show about the age groups. So you've got a sort of 25% success rate, if you like, in 30 to 34, 6% 40 to 44, 1% over 45. Now you might be thinking, well, 45, that's a bit old. But it's not. It's still a possibility. And not irregularly, we'll hear news stories about the grandmother-aged woman who has just given birth for IVF. There's this kind of sense that because technology opens up the possibilities for us, there is no age that's out of bounds. And it even gets more complicated than that, because now the ability to harvest eggs and store them, not just store embryos, opens up the possibility for women who are getting to that phase of menopause where they realise that they won't be producing any more eggs, of taking some of the eggs and storing them until the right time is there, and then having them fertilised and then implanted. I heard this somewhat disturbing story. I think it was, I can't remember what podcast it was, I think it was This American Life or something like that. Maybe it wasn't This American Life. In New York, they have egg parties where successful kind of successful women who are still single but, you know, have realised that they still want children, but then they don't have a partner and they don't have any sort of thinking that would allow them to say now is the right time. IVF providers hold these egg parties, like cocktail parties, where they kind of say, come, we'll tell you about about storing your eggs for that time down the track, when you're ready to be able to do it. See, the technology opens up a whole range of possibilities that could be good, but need really careful thought as well. And one last point before I kind of draw it to a close is just to kind of recognise the cost. Because while we're very fortunate in Australia in one way that our government provides rebates for medical treatment, and this is a medical treatment, so there are rebates, there's still a cost involved. And so I would say to the Christian disciple that that one of the factors that you need to consider is what is the appropriate way to use the resources God has given you. I'm not saying this is an inappropriate way, but if it is going to cost you, then you need to be aware of that. So you're making a reasonable and thought through and wise approach. So here you just see some of the figures. So an IVF cycle The costs are about, this is pulled off this provider's website from last night. The costs are about $9,000. You get a rebate, and so the estimated out-of-cost cost, you know that. But it's not just that, because you've also got to pay for freezing the eggs and storing the eggs, and then every time, and then if you want to use one of those embryos, you'll also have a frozen embryo cycle. So if you've made a commitment that you're going to store four, and you're going to see each one of those four have an opportunity to come to birth, so an opportunity for you to implant them into your body as a woman and see whether a pregnancy ensues, then you're up for that cost. And then there's other costs as well. So embryo freezing costs and storage costs and various other things that can happen. And they are a provider, a service delivery, they are a business. There'll be a whole range of added extras, you want fries with that kind of thing, that the IVF provider will offer you. Genetic testing is a whole range of other ethical issues there. Genetic testing, for instance, so you make sure that this embryo is the right embryo. What happens if it's the wrong embryo? Just because it's not what you want, or even if it's got some sort of genetic condition or problem, if it's still a human being, it's still a human being. Yep.
Does that generally happen just automatically
with providers, or? No, it will be offered. But the sorts of things that they test for are limited, but usually quite significant. No, not genetic screening, although what I haven't talked about is that most IVF providers will have a kind of a process by which they grade or determine which are good embryos, which are the best embryos, and there's a whole body of literature to say whether or not that grading is in any way indicative of a success, if you like, in terms of pregnancy or live birth. So sometimes embryos look beautiful and symmetrical, and they're divided one into two cells, two into four, four into eight, eight into 16. They're lovely, beautiful, symmetrical, and you kind of think, oh, that's very nice, it looks very good. And sometimes they don't divide like that. Sometimes it goes one into two and two into three, and you know, and they look a bit kind of wobbly and not beautiful and symmetrical. And you kind of might look down the microscope and think, well, that one looks good, and that one, well, I'm not sure, there's no really good evidence to say that one that looks a bit unusual won't necessarily develop into a perfectly normal, healthy pregnancy and a perfectly normal, healthy live birth. So there's a whole range of things that kind of, and you see why the IVF providers might do that, because they're in the job of giving you a baby. So anything that they can do to kind of, to select an embryo that they think will be the best for you, they're going to want to do, because they're in the job of giving you a baby. Genetic testing isn't necessary, and you don't have to do it. It's a choice that if you went to IVF that you would need to make. And it's a choice that has implications. So if you get the genetic test, what are you going to do with the results? Because you'd only have a genetic test if you're going to act on the results. So if you'd only have a genetic test if you're going to say, okay, well, I won't take that embryo, but I will take that embryo. And depending on what you think of the embryo, you may not want to do that. You may want to say each embryo is a neighbour. Each embryo is worthy of a chance, if you like. Now, there's some of the costs and some of the other things, but just to tie up and then, where do we land on all of this? If you are a Christian couple, and there maybe you might be sitting here sort of listening to this, and you already know most of this information because you're already invested into this space. It's not an academic issue. It's not just an interesting issue, but it's an issue that is deeply personal and painful at the moment. What do we do with all of this information? Children are a gift from God, And whether they come in the way that we want or some other means, through adoption or maybe through ART, we should always have that as the sort of the overarching framework, that children, as they come to us, are a gift from God. Maybe with all of this in mind, you might think, you might come to the conclusion, well, this just, it's the moral sort of maze that we'd have to negotiate to try and do this well means that we won't start. And I would say that's a decision that wouldn't be a wrong decision. You might choose not to do this because you don't think that you will be able to kind of come to all the conclusions that you need to come to about all of the sort of things that, and maybe you go down the pathway of adoption with all of the complications and costs involved with that. Or maybe you might say, well, God has, as much as agrees us, given us as a family the context where we won't have our own children. But we can still be welcoming children into the context of our home. We can still be those great aunties and uncles, maybe not biological, of the children of the church or my immediate family. All of those things are possible. But equally possible, I think, is to negotiate the complication of IVF and step into that space thinking through carefully and prayerfully what it would look like to engage with this. To say, well, if the embryo is a person, what does that mean about how many embryos we'll have made to start with and our commitment to them as we go along? And maybe by making some decisions about having a very limited number of embryos and being committed to each one, even if they're frozen, to come back to, you're going to reduce the success rate. And the IVF provider might look at you very strangely and even put pressure on you to not do it that way because you might not have a child. But if you have a moral commitment, if you like, to this unborn one, this neighbour who doesn't look much like a neighbour, then maybe that's the way you negotiate it. And I would say that there's Christian freedom to step into that space, to do those things. But the freedom comes with the responsibility to not blindly sort of step into that space, but know that as you step in and you take action, then whenever we do that as human beings, whenever we do that as disciples of Jesus, every action that we take that I put myself into comes with a responsibility to kind of think carefully about what am I doing, in how is what I'm doing impacting on my relationships, the relationship with the embryo, the relationship with my wife, the relationship with others around me, my relationship with God. So I'm not going to tell you what you should do. I never do. I just ask the questions, really. But I'm saying there is a possibility of engaging with IVF in a Christian way. But you don't have to engage in IVF if you're a Christian who is suffering from infertility.